6 minutes after the hour, good evening to you. My name is Lee Rayburn, filling in for the Air Americans this evening, coming to you from Madison, Wisconsin. And let me ask you something. When you refuse to accept Orwellian logic like war is peace, when it comes to our foreign policy, why is it that we so blindly accept Orwellian logic like killing is kindness when it comes to our animal rescue? Here to tell us about a better way is the author of Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution in America. For any cat or dog lover in this country, it is an absolute must-read. Our guest this evening is the author of that book, Nathan Winograd. Good evening, Nathan.
Hi, Lee.
Hey, it's great to speak to you once again, and I'm so proud to be able to share your information with the rest of the country. And I want to start, since we have an hour together, at the beginning. And I want to start with the beginning of the animal rights movement, or the I believe the original ASPCA back in the 19th century.
That's correct. A name that's been, unfortunately, for most people, lost in history is a man by the name of Henry Berg. And Henry Berg was a diplomat. Abraham Lincoln appointed him to the court of the Tsar of Russia, a post he absolutely hated. And so he would spend most of his days not on his official diplomatic duties, but taking aimless carriage rides around the streets of St. Petersburg. And legend has it that on one of those rides, he saw a Russian peasant beating his donkey, and he stepped up. You know, he stepped out of his carriage and ordered the man to stop, and he did. And Henry Berg later wrote that it was at that moment that he really found his calling in life. In fact, he quit the next day, came back to the United States, and started the first Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals.
And that was in New York City, wasn't it?
That was in New York City, and at the time, New York City had the distinction of having more animal residents in the city than people. And in fact, one of the primary reasons for the city's meteoric rise in size was that it had the first horse railway in the United States, and thousands of people used to take these horses throughout the city to get to and from work. And Henry Berg, when he arrived, literally saw on every street, as part of every industry, a society that was built on the back of suffering animals. And he delivered the first lecture in the United States on animal protection, demanding mercy toward animals. And a few days later, the ASPCA was born and really started the humane movement in the United States and throughout North America.
In your book, Redemption, you detail just how militant Henry Berg was. And it's really, it almost seems like here's a man who was way ahead of his time. I mean, this is a guy that would storm the streets of New York City castigating people who were hurting their animals.
Yeah, it really is. I would say it's probably not unique to the humane movement. I mean, social movements are littered with examples of really innovative, zealous people who are pure of their convictions, who start these movements, and over time, they, you know, the zeal with which the reformers started the movement get lost. And even though some of these organizations get very big and very powerful and very wealthy, they also become bureaucratic with none of the zeal that characterizes the movement's early founders. And as it's true in a lot of other movements, it's also unfortunately true in the animal movement. Unfortunately, in the animal movement, the repercussion has meant the killing of 5 million dogs and cats a year, which would have hurt Henry Berg very deeply.
What is the leading cause of death for healthy cats and dogs in the United States today?
Well, the leading cause of death for healthy dogs and cats in the United States is shelter killing. And, you know, that statistic, my hope is that statistic horrifies people, because, in fact, the institutions that were founded to protect animals, to promote their rights, to ensure their life-saving, in fact, have become the leading killers of dogs and cats in the United States, despite the fact that these organizations have also become very, very wealthy, have gained the technical means to end the killing, and they are supported by a pet-loving American public that not only spends somewhere in the neighborhood of $35 billion on their own animals, but donates.
Did you say billion with a B, Nathan?
Billion with a B.
A year?
A year. That's how much Americans spend caring for their own pets. Now, that doesn't include the hundreds of millions of dollars a year that they also spent in terms of donations to these charities. Their tax money is going to support some of these charities. And if you include in-kind donations like their volunteerism and other things, the figure reaches $1 billion. And despite all that money and all that caring, shelters, in fact, are still the number one killers of dogs and cats in the United States.
And yet, as you say, Nathan, there is another way. There is a better way, and it is you have found it. And I want to go a little bit through your experience in animal rescue and animal shelter. How did you get started in the entire field?
Well, in terms of a vocation, I've been an animal lover all my life. In fact, our house growing up, my mom was one of the original cat ladies of the neighborhood.
One of those.
Yeah, I still remember my father arguing with the neighbors on why he should be allowed to feed the birds, despite the fact that they did their business on the neighbor's roof. Really, in terms of a vocation, I went to law school, and while at law school, I ran into a woman who was feeding all these cats that lived on the campus, and got to talking with her and learned a little bit about shelter practices in the United States. I mean, I'm almost ashamed to admit that I was very naive, and I guess, like a lot of people, thought that shelters were staffed by people who would do everything in their power to avoid shelter killing. You know, leave no stone unturned and stop at nothing, and would only use killing as a last resort. And when the administration at Stanford University announced plans that they were going to round up and kill the 1,500 cats that made their home on the campus, these are wild cats that, they're exactly the same as the cat that you talk about, Lee, but only they're not socialized to people. A group of students, faculty, and staff turned to the local shelter for help, and in fact, the local shelter agreed with the university, saying that these cats should be killed. And not happy with that response, the group turned to the nation's wealthiest and largest animal protection organization in the entire world, the Humane Society of the United States, hoping for a different answer, but they got the same one, that since these cats were not social to human, then they should be taken to shelters and killed.
In fact, Nathan, it's not just the Humane Society and the American Society for the Prevention of the Cruelty to Animals. It's also PETA.
That's actually it's very true and very shocking to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Here's an organization that is, spending millions of dollars around the globe arguing that pigs, chickens, rats, and other animals are worthy of our compassion and have a right to live. And yet, when it comes to those animals that are closest to us as Americans, our pets, our dogs and our cats.
My significant other.
Yeah. Well, your family members. Our
exactly.
Family members. They, in fact, argue the opposite. Not only do they advocate shelter killing, they are openly hostile to life-saving alternatives like the no-kill philosophy. They kill about 90% of the 2,000 dogs and cats they claim to rescue every year.
Whoa. Well, blows my mind. Because...
And the ultimate irony, and I think, having read his letters and gone through some of the archival evidence, it really would have hurt Henry Berg very deeply, because the vehicle that he found to save lives, in fact, has become essentially a network of humane societies and SPCAs and organizations that do little more than kill dogs and cats.
And yet there is a better way. There is a benevolent way to treat our family members, our cats and our dogs. And that's why I've asked Nathan Winograd to join us this evening, because he's found that better way. And it is as simple as no kill. Nathan Winograd's my guest. He is the author of Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution in America. We have merely set up a little bit of the background where animal rescue started, where it is today. We will fill in the middle part next and then move on to where we are going in the future, and it is simple. We just got to stop killing them. The idea of killing is kindness is as Orwellian as war is peace. And if you don't accept it from your administration's foreign policy, then you shouldn't accept it from your animal rescue community either. We will continue the conversation with Nathan Winograd, who is living, breathing proof that no kill is a solution, and we will talk about that next. It is 16 minutes after the hour. My name is Lee Rayburn, filling in for the Air Americans this evening. 866-303-2270. You are listening to Air America Radio.
866-303-2270. It's the Air Americans.
Air Americans. 21 minutes after the hour, my name is Lee Rayburn. My guest this evening is the author of Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution in America. His name, Nathan Winograd. You can find him online at nathanwinograd.com. And Nathan, the idea generally is that there are too many cats and dogs and not enough homes to put them in. And that is why PETA insists and the ASPCA insists and the Humane Society of America insists that killing is kindness. What's wrong with that myth?
Well, what's wrong with it is that it's unfortunately, it's wrong. And in fact, it's completely made up. And the reason they perpetuate that conclusion is very simple. They look at the number of animals coming into shelters. They look at the number of animals going home into, you know, either being reclaimed by their owners or being adopted, and then they look at the number of animals killed, and because in the vast majority of shelters, the numbers of animals going home alive versus killed is so skewed to killing, they've come up with this notion that there's more animals than there are available homes, and you know there's no better proof than that is false. One, the data shows it's false. There's every year, Americans are bringing a new dog into their home. There are more homes opening up each year, twice as many homes, in fact, as there are dogs entering shelters, and more homes opening up for cats than there are cats that are entering shelters. The problem is that shelters have been doing such a lousy job of getting their animals into those homes, and when you look at certain communities that have actually done a good job, in fact, they found that they can adopt all their healthy and treatable animals without the need to kill. So I guess that's a long way of saying that the best proof that it's not true is the fact that we now have 5 no-kill communities in the United States and growing.
And we'll talk about 2 of them, one a urban setting, one a rural setting, where that has been the case. First, I want to take a call. Robin's listening online at airamerica.com. She is a veterinarian. Robin, you are on Air America Radio with Nathan Winograd, the author of Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution in America.
Hi, how are you tonight?
Good, thank you.
I'm just calling in because I actually am a veterinarian, and I work at a no-kill animal control facility. And I don't have a specific question, but I basically want to back you up on everything you're saying here. I think there's a lot of myth out there about shelter animals being placed, and our little shelter finds homes for everybody. We only euthanize when it's medically necessary, and we find homes for animals that would be considered unadoptable just about anywhere else.
I can hear him now.
Pardon?
I can hear him now.
Yeah.
Robin, where are you located?
Well, I actually live in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm in the same town as Lee is.
Great.
But I work in Monroe, which is about an hour south of here, and the organization is called the Green County Humane Society. And we provide, animal control for Green County, Wisconsin, which has a population of about 38,000. And we provide some animal control for dogs only right now for Lafayette County, which has a population of around 17,000. So it's a very rural area, and we don't have a huge number of animals coming in. We deal with about 950 a year.
Okay.
But a previous board made the decision to go no-kill back in 2001, and we've so far managed to maintain that.
Thank you, Robin. I very much appreciate it. And Nathan, your experience with a rural setting and creating a no-kill animal rescue community took place in Tompkins County, New York. In 2002, it became the first no-kill community in the United States. Tell us a little bit about how do you start walking into an animal rescue center and the killing is kindness mentality?
Well, you know, the first thing is, you know, I want to, you know, I think what Robin's doing great is great, but I want to kind of back up the way you opened tonight's segment regarding Orwellian logic and language. And, you know, the one issue I take with Robin is the concept of euthanasia, because when it's applied to healthy animals and adoptable animals and animals that should not be killed, it's not euthanasia, it's killing. And I think it's important that we start to use the correct language, because it's the euphemisms like killing is kindness, like euthanasia, like, in fact, even Animal Rescue Center, that allows people to create a false image in their mind that these agencies are, in fact, refuges of care for these animals, when in many cases they're little more than death camps for them. But when I walked into Tompkins County, it was a shelter that was very typically of most animal control agencies nationwide. It had an underperforming staff. They had a built-in excuse, the myth of pet overpopulation, which allowed them to kill with impunity because they could blame someone else for their own failures to really put in place the programs and services that save lives. And I remember when I walked my first day as the agency's new chief, I was met in the parking lot by a gentleman that had five kittens that he no longer wanted. And in most shelters, that is really the point where the breakdown occurs. In most shelters, those kittens would have been killed, and the fault would have been laid at the feet of the truck driver.
The guy that brought in the five cats.
Yes. Now, there's no doubt that he could have been more responsible with his own cat, but that is, in fact, and I'm not excusing the conduct, I'm just saying that is why shelters exist in the first place.
Nathan, we've got to take a break for bills, but we'll pick it up right where you left off, right there at Tompkins County, right there where you walk in the door of the shelter for the first time and are met with a box of kittens. And what happens with those kittens, it really lays the groundwork for what happens in Tompkins County, which in 2002 became the first no-kill community in the United States, which is now spreading to Charlottesville, Virginia, and across the country. And we'll tell you how you can do it in your hometown next with Nathan Winograd, the author of Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution in America. Find out more online at nathanwinograd.com. Our conversation continues next. My name is Lee Rayburn. You're listening to the only place you'll hear such talk, Air America Radio.
Now, back to the Air Americans on Air America.
5 million cats and dogs are killed every year in U.S. animal shelters. Do they need to be? Our guest this evening is the author of Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation, and the No-Kill Revolution in America, Nathan Winograd. And Nathan, before the break, you were telling the story about how you were hired to come run the Tompkins County, New York Animal Shelter, how you uprooted your family and brought them to Tompkins County in your first day on the job. Before you even walk in the front door, in the parking lot of the shelter, is a truck driver with five cats. And that's where the story begins of the no-kill movement that started it all.
And as I was saying before the break, I mean, that really is the point where the breakdown occurs, and most shelters would kill those five cats and then lay the blame at the feet of the truck driver. But, you know, one, I didn't travel 3,000 miles from San Francisco to kill dogs and cats that were savable, and two, having come from what was at the time the most successful city in the United States, saving about 7 out of 10 dogs and cats, I knew what worked and what didn't work. And unfortunately, in San Francisco, while we were saving all healthy dogs and cats in city animal shelters, I felt that we could do more. And I wanted to prove that we could not only save all the healthy dogs and cats, but those that come to a shelter sick or injured or traumatized, essentially with broken bones and broken spirits, in the same way that we proved you can save healthy animals. And that really was my goal in Tompkins County. And so the next step was putting in place the programs and services to make it possible.
Am I oversimplifying it by saying, Nathan, that step one to creating a no-kill animal shelter is to stop killing?
It's not an oversimplification. In fact, if you look at all those communities that are currently experiencing no-kill success, and if you just listen to what Robin, the veterinarian from Monroe, Wisconsin, said, basically it starts with an act of will. And in the case of her shelter, the board said, we're going to stop the killing, and they've been doing it ever since. And in the case of Tompkins County, by taking it off the table, it forces shelters to be creative and flexible and do what it takes other than the quick and easy solution, which is, you know, death by lethal injection, essentially an overdose of barbiturates or gassing in the United States. And it's not just stopping the killing, but it's actually putting in place the programs and services that allow animals to move through the system so that you don't get clogged with the influx. But essentially, that is the first and most important first step.
It's genius to me, having been on the air for 3 hours so far, Nathan, and having all these complex solutions that need to be done in order to end a war, in order to rebuild our infrastructure throughout the United States. And then we get to animal rescue, and we get to shelters, and we get to the problem of killing 5 million cats and dogs every year in U.S. animal shelters. And step one, as far as solutions go, is as simple as stop killing. All right, we're there. So what's step two?
Well, step two is putting in place the series of programs and services that allowed San Francisco to become the first city in the nation to end the killing of healthy animals, and then put in place with rigor in Tompkins County allowed it to become the first no-kill community. And those are a series of programs and services that take care of at-risk animals without resorting to the need to kill. And, there's a number of them, and I'll just run through some of them very quickly. But, for example, a significant number of animals come into the shelter and they're not yet ready for adoption. So, for example, you might get kittens that are too young to be adopted. They're still nursing, or dogs that have behavior problems that need one-on-one care before they're ready to be placed into a home. Well, most shelters, because they have the built-in excuse of pet overpopulation, kill those animals and move on to the next. Whereas in San Francisco and in Tompkins County and now other places, we put in place the programs to care for their animals. And perhaps one of the most important programs, if not the most important, is allowing citizens in the community, animal lovers in the community, to provide temporary foster care for these animals. And the beauty of the program is that the private people provide that care at their own expense in their own homes, so it allows you to really maximize your life saving at very little cost. And in fact, if you go through all these programs to neuter the feral cats, for example, like we did on the Stanford University campus, and then return them to their habitats and have volunteers feed them every day of their lives, programs to work with the many rescue groups in the community. You know, in California, for example, Lee, shelters were killing about 75% of all the animals coming through collectively as a state, and yet refusing to give some of the animals that were facing death to rescue groups who were not only willing to provide these animals a home, but guaranteeing that they would do so and do so at their own expense.
That doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense, but what happened, the reason for that is that rescue groups go to shelters on a daily basis, and they see staff abuse, they see the shelter not doing enough to save lives, they see the empty cages despite the killing, and so a lot of shelters in California were actually premising working with these rescue groups on the agreement of the rescue groups not to be vocal about some of the abuses they encountered. And it took passing a law in California in 1998 that guaranteed these rescue groups right to these animals so that it wouldn't have to be premised on silence as to some of the abuses going on in shelters. So if you put in place all those programs, high volume spaying and neutering, programs to help people overcome the issues that might force them or cause them to relinquish animals to the shelters, working with volunteers, all those programs allowed Tompkins County to be successful. But the one program, it's not really a program, the one thing that was most important of all was a leadership change. If you look at communities, not just San Francisco and Tompkins, but places like Charlottesville, Virginia, which is no-kill, places like Washoe County, Nevada, what really caused the change, what caused death rates to really flip overnight, declined 50-75% reduction in killing in 1 year, is when their longtime directors, who were vested in the status quo and hiding behind this myth of too many animals, were replaced by really compassionate people who not only had the skills to turn the shelter around, but were passionate about it. And in fact, you look at some of these communities, Lee, and despite the fact that they were criticized for overkill and for not doing enough to save lives, when they replaced their long-term directors with new ones, they are now, leading the pack of the United States in life-saving.
One of my favorite stories in redemption, Nathan, is when you get to Tompkins County and you get the opportunity to use the media. And you take that opportunity and don't put out your brightest or fluffiest cat or dog. You take the most mangled, the one in the most need of care, and you put them front and center in the media, and you say, this is the guy that needs your help more than any. Sure, he has seizures. Sure, he has three legs, but he'll still love you like no other, and he just needs a good home. And it was through taking the bottom-up approach, the least desirable animals, and making those the ones that you promote. It's evident to me, Nathan, that the commitment was started with the idea that we're not going to kill any animals, any healthy animals, any salvageable animals, and we'll figure the rest out as we go.
Absolutely. I mean, there's always going to be some animals who are hopelessly ill or injured or suffering, and, you know, there is mercy euthanasia for those animals. But if you look at successful communities, we're talking about 6-7% of the animals, not half of them or to 80% as the killing occurs in some communities.
Ooh.
But what I've found is that, one of the problems is that shelters see the public as the source of the problem.
How so, Nathan? That doesn't make any sense to me. How can we be the problem? We the ones who are willing to donate to the shelters. We the ones who are willing to adopt the cats or dogs out of the shelters. How are we the problem?
I agree with you.
I'm a little angry.
and you should be, particularly when 4.1 of the 5 million animals that are killed every year in the United States don't have to be killed and shouldn't be killed. But, you know, the argument is that people surrender animals to shelters. And what I lay out in 240 pages and what I think is an unassailable argument is it's the shelters that kill them, and one does not necessarily follow the other. But the problem is, because they blame the public, which is their ready-made excuse to avoid accountability, they can't or won't make the mental leap that even though there's a small section of the American public that they're responsible with their pets, the vast majority of Americans are incredibly compassionate. And if you reach out to them, if you ask them not only to open up their hearts and homes, but embrace your life-saving initiative by bringing in not just the cute and cuddly puppies and kittens, but what I affectionately call the old and uglies, those that are injured and traumatized. And so the reality is that the vast majority of animals coming into shelters are young and healthy. So I don't want to give the impression that they're not. But good homes can be found for the blind dogs and the three-legged cats and the animals that most communities would consider unadoptable and kill without ever giving them a chance. And we gave all those animals a chance in Tompkins County, and they're now being given a chance in Reno, Nevada, in Washoe County, in Ivan City, Utah, and increasingly in other places, proving definitively that the killing is both unnecessary and cruel.
We have a call from Paul. Paul, you are on Air America Radio with Nathan Winograd, the author of Redemption, the Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution in America.
Hi, Lee. Hi, Nathan. I've been following you since about 99 when I first attended a conference that you attended, and I'm looking forward to meeting you when you come here to Madison.
That's great.
I had just kind of an idea came to me as I was listening to you tonight about the reluctance that you seem to be talking about among these shelters to try bold new things, and especially like with fostering or adoption programs at car dealerships or shopping malls or, you know, really oddball things. And I wonder if part of that sort of retentiveness on their part isn't perhaps sort of an analog to one of the things I've been sort of studying and interested in is this notion of animal collectors, hoarders, people who end up with way too many animals. And in great part, it's because they think, in their minds, no one can take better care of my animals than me. They get this phobia about releasing them to anyone, about letting go of that control. And I wonder if that same sort of control freak mentality and possibly, again, the same sort of mechanism, mental mechanism that goes into animal hoarding is what's clogging things up with these shelters and why they maybe think that some of these animals are better off dead than in cages or in foster homes or in shopping malls or what have you. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I think what you're saying, Paul, and the way I'll respond to it is that is the great tragedy that has occurred over the years. The vision of Henry Burke to create these agencies of compassion have, in fact, the control part of it has completely overrun the compassion part. And what ends up happening is that, they completely elevate the risk that is inherent in all of life. I mean, life is a series of happy events and sad events, good events, bad events. A risk is an inherent part of just being alive, and yet they elevate that risk so that it's no longer based in reality. They underplay the benefits, and as a result, they turn to killing as this notion that at least we know where they are. They happen to be in landfills and body bags. In fact, I mean, you laugh, but the seminal essay written by the Humane Society of the United States, their vice president for companion animals, actually in writing she stated that she personally put to death 70,000 dogs and cats and has never worried about a single one, but she worries about the ones she adopted every single day. She still worries about them. And this notion that because some of the animals might suffer, or some of the animals in the future might meet an undesired fate, or some of them might not be adopted into the best homes, we're going to kill all of them now so that we don't have to take those risks. And I'll tell you, if the dogs and cats could talk, they'd be begging for that risk.
Yes, we will take that risk. Paul, I appreciate the call. Nathan, I think this is revolutionary, and I kind of feel ashamed to say that it's revolutionary, but we're so behind the times on this. This is something we should have caught up to a long time ago. And we should mention that also Nathan is about ready to begin a coast-to-coast tour to promote the book and should be coming to a town near you. More importantly than promoting the book, promoting the no-kill revolution in America. We will conclude our conversation next with Nathan Winograd, the author of Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution in America. You can keep up with his, where he is going this fall at NathanWinograd.com. My name is Lee Rayburn, filling in for the Air Americans this evening. It is 48 minutes after the hour, and you are listening to Air America Radio.
Now more than ever, it's the Air Americans, heard only on Air America.
Ask our next guest about solutions, but I have a solution before he even answers. I'm Lee Rayburn, filling in for the Air Americans this evening. My guest is Nathan Winograd. He is the author of Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution in America. And if you are looking to implement a no-kill shelter community for our cats and dogs in our backyard, here's what you do. Pick up a copy of Nathan's book. Get educated with the history of animal shelters and get educated with how we can take it and move it into the future. The time has come to evolve when it comes to how we treat our cats and dogs, our family members, and in my case, my significant other. And now, Nathan, I'll turn it over to you and ask, what can we do to solve the 5 million cats and dogs, healthy cats and dogs, that are being killed every year in our U.S. animal shelters?
Well, the first thing that we shouldn't do is continue to wait. I mean, it has been about 12 years since San Francisco first gave us the keys to how to end the killing, and it's been 5 years now since Tompkins County became the first no-kill community, and now there's almost a half a dozen others that have followed the model and basically become no-kill virtually overnight. So there's no longer a need to wait. And the second thing we can't do, even though we're told over and over in this movement to do this, is to collaborate with shelters that have so far refused to change. At some point, you have to realize that if they're not going to willingly change in light of the fact that we now know how to end the killing and several communities have done it, then we need to force some of these long-term shelter directors out and replace them with more compassionate ones. But there's two things that we've done, and I appreciate you telling people to pick up the book. There's two things that we've done with this book that's very different from most books. One, we've bypassed the hardcover copy because we wanted to reduce the cost as much as possible so that wouldn't be a bar to people picking up a copy. And the second thing we're doing is rather than a typical national book tour where you go to a book tour and you do a small reading and then a book signing, we're actually giving free hour and a 1.5 public seminars on how to build the no-kill community around the country. And we'll go through all the programs and services. We'll go through what has worked and what has not worked. And we'll give people the tools they need to challenge the status quo in their own hometowns and not just fight but demand and actually get not just no-kill shelters. Because if you look at around the country, there are a lot of no-kill shelters. What we want to build are no-kill communities, and through that create a no-kill nation and end the killing of over 4 million animals a year that should be walking around this earth today, but unfortunately are going to lose their lives for no other reason than they entered a shelter that has not embraced a culture of life-saving.
I can't accept that. I just cannot accept that. And until we get to that point, Nathan, I will continue to promote the work you are doing on behalf of my family, as small as it may be. It is still important to me, and it is still family. Nathan Winograd, thank you so much. I can't wait till you come to our community to speak to us, and I hope everybody reads Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation and the No-Kill Revolution in America. Thank you, sir.
The pleasure is all mine.
Nathan Winograd. You can find him online at nathanwinograd.com. That'll do it for us tonight. Thank you for being a part of the best 4 hours of my day. I want to thank our guest, John Stauber, the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, Bill Verkess, the president of the American Public Works Association, Kurt Mann, the filmmaker that made AmericanGreen.tv, Paul Soglin, the former mayor of Madison, online at waxingamerica.com, and of course, one of my heroes, Nathan Winograd, the author of Redemption, The Myth of Pet Overpopulation, and the No-Kill Revolution in America, online at nathanwinograd.com. My name is Lee Rayburn, filling in for the Air Americans this evening. Thank you for making me a part of your evening. I will talk to you again right here on Air America Radio.